You're listening to The Read Out, one development leader, their big idea, and how it can shape the future of Australian development assistance. Hosted by Lab CEO, Bridie Rice.
One of the unique things about Australia's development program, in contrast to other arms of Australian statecraft, is that it is almost entirely delivered by organisations other than our government. Sure, Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade sets the strategic directions. They make big decisions about where money goes and what for what purpose. But of the $32 billion under aid management at any given point in time, the vast majority of this is delivered through a range of local organisations, universities, social enterprises, NGOs, and of course, managing contractors, those companies who specialise in delivering on the intentions of our government when it comes to development. Now, on the one hand, this is normal. We can't expect our diplomats and bureaucrats to both manage and be the boots on the ground of Australian development programs. Just like you don't go to your doctors for your dentistries, nor do we want our foreign policy architects doing the complex work of supporting communities and delivering programs designed to unlock economic growth. These are specialist skills that these development organisations have built up over decades. But there have been a number of voices indicating a growing concern over how Australia's aid industry, as they put it, is not necessarily tooled to deliver on the aspirations of the people of the Pacific Islands. Some critics point to the consolidation of aid contracts in fewer development organisations. Others point to the old-school principles of rich donors and poor recipients that aid organisations were founded on, worried that this can disempower communities in the Pacific Islands. But one voice consistently raising this concern is that of Solly Middleby, PhD scholar at Adelaide University, former aid bureaucrat and aid project team leader. Solly, it is great to have you here.
It's lovely to be here, Bridie.
Now, in July this year, Dame Meg Taylor and Solly published an academic article called Aid is Not Development, The True Character of Pacific Aid. It certainly caught the attention of a few of us here at the lab, as well as many in the Pacific Islands. And you can catch our interview with Dame Meg Taylor on The Readout if you haven't listened already. With Dame Meg Taylor, we discussed the Pacific experience of Australian development captured in the article. But with Solly, I want to dive into the Australian side of the story. So, Solly, I've watched your writing and your provocations on social media over the years. And in this article with Dame Meg Taylor, I really saw your ideas starting to take form in a deeper and a more structured way than I'd seen previously. Is this remotely how it felt as you put pen to paper on the article?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to thank you for engaging with us and our critique or provocation, as you called it. You know, in a way, everyone's sort of implicated in our critique, you know, including yourself and the lab. So I just wanted to acknowledge your leadership in leaning into these questions. But basically, yes, is the answer to your question. That's exactly how it felt to have the space to really think. And of course, to do so with an amazing intellect like Dame Meg Taylor, who's immune from accepting the status quo when it's not good enough, and really exceptional at questioning assumptions that, you know, at many points I didn't even know I had. So I've spent the last 20 years, I guess, in a bit of a state of discomfort about the aid industry, right from my first highly overpaid role. And, you know, over that time, I have done plenty of reflection and, of course, plenty of justifying of that discomfort and my own role in the industry. But it's only really been since I made the decision to leave, you know, after realizing, you know, 20 years in that perhaps this system isn't going to change, you know, perhaps it's actually getting worse. Perhaps there's a more useful role I can play outside it. Only since making that decision that I've really had the time and space to actually stop and pause and think. So it was an amazing experience to sort back through my own reflections, you know, through Dame Meg's and through so many others. And then, you know, to try and explore more deeply with her these patterns we could see, you know, and then to just keep asking ourselves why, you know, why, until it started to make more sense in a bit more of a deep and structured way, as you say.
So let's turn to those patterns. Your research finds that there are three clear shifts in Australian aid over the last decade. So first up, you're saying that aid has become more politicised, deployed to support Australia's interests more than those interests of the Pacific. Secondly, you've said that aid is becoming increasingly privatised, with local Pacific companies marginalised quite often. And third, your work finds that aid has been increasingly contested by the peoples of the Pacific. Of these three patterns that you're seeing, what is worrying you the most?
I don't know whether it's so useful for me to separate them, because I think what worries me the most and what worried me the most writing the paper was when we looked at these, you know, these trends or these shifts and the incentives around them, was how they sort of all seem to be mutually reinforcing each other. So it wasn't really them individually now that I worry about, but I think the way they're working together. If you see more and more aid feeling like it's being used as this kind of blatant geostrategic tool for what I know in many people's opinion is a pretty limited notion of the national interest, the more it is going to be contested. And I think, you know, Australia is losing control, if it ever even had it completely, but it's losing, you know, fast losing any grip on the narrative around family, around Vivale, around Falepili being the good neighbour. It's increasingly contested by communities, you know, by leaders, even by our own citizens at home. And when you then surround yourself by private companies and other intermediaries who are, you know, quite restricted in their ability to really offer a critique of the system, well, that's not really going to help either. So what worries me most, I guess, from the analysis is, you know, seeing these trends driven by these incentives that are more likely to see the system we've sort of described, you know, which is a largely unchecked donor-driven system. There's a lot of power imbalance. We see it as probably mostly benefiting itself and its agents, and really failing kind of consistently to support and empower Pacific agency or reduce dependency at all. So those sort of trends and incentives seem like they're just reinforcing those features, and that's to all of our detriment.
I mean, let's be honest, Sully, this is not the first time that you and I have had this conversation. And when it starts to unfold, we often find ourselves bantering back and forth, me trying to convince you that there are green shoots of reform on foot for development cooperation, that we can reimagine such a thing is possible for Australia to be a great nation when it comes to supporting development in the region, and you pointing me hard and fast to some pretty solid evidence of the contrary. But interestingly, we do sometimes find ourselves coming together around the idea that even if a positive reform of the broken system you're talking about can't come from Australian development leaders and the Australian aid industry, it will be demanded by people of places like the Pacific. So, Sully, we know what your concerns are. Those that have read your work do too. But where are you seeing the greatest hope for Pacific development coming from?
I mean, it's a really good question. I've also enjoyed our debates on these issues, and I certainly wish that the analysis didn't point to these findings. My hope really is, though, that we don't leave this mess, which is really our mess, to the developmental leaders of the Pacific to fix, that we realise, in fact, these leaders have, you know, enough to focus on. The list is never ending. And while I definitely have a personal belief that at the moment, you know, the reform is not coming from within the system because of the incentive framework of the system, and I do believe that Pacific states and societies actually have much more power to change the rules of the game, you know, I just acknowledge the cognitive load that they often carry that frankly we don't. And I think we need more people in the system to step up and call out publicly what they often do privately. So I guess my hope is that people such as yourself and your listeners and the many people who benefit and have built careers as, you know, development specialists, advisors and experts will act a bit more on the discomfort that I know the majority, I think, feel. And that people will join Dame Meg, myself, and many others who are trying to grow this conversation and call for much more substantive reform and much more strategic imagination than we're currently seeing. But I think my real hope for having a more, you know, just aid system is really part of a bigger hope that one day we'll be able to hold our head a little bit higher as settler Australians. I'm not sure for me it's ever hung so low than this last few months. But we are part of a nation that's built directly on stolen land of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but we're also a nation that was built on stolen people from across the Pacific for, you know, there's over 100 years of slavery from the extraction of the Pacific's resources, including a whole island, Barnaba, for our own development. So part of the discomfort I think we feel actually sits on, you know, these historic injustices, which we know are sort of reverberating through time. And my greatest hope is that in the decades to come, we'll be able to hold our heads a bit higher.
Well, Sully, believe it or not, it is almost time to wrap up this episode, but it couldn't be happening on a stronger note. So before you go, I want you to tackle our standing lab hypothetical. And I want you to imagine that you are about to board an elevator. And as you turn to your left, you see Australia's Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Pat Conroy. He is the man who has a pretty big say about how the Australian aid industry operates. And you realise that you only have 1 minute with him inside this elevator. So I want you to tell us, what is the one thing you think he must understand when it comes to Australian aid in the Pacific? Over to you.
I kind of can't stop giggling because when you describe it like that, all I can imagine is him trying to like shut the thing before I can get in. But
imagine he doesn't. He's a pretty friendly guy, right? He's going to hear you out.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, I guess I'm not convinced that the minister or really anyone close around him even sees this problem. So I guess the one thing I'd want to say to the minister would be, please get some contestability around you. Shuffle the deck chairs, minister. You are surrounded really by the architects and the implementers of the failed DFAT AusAid integration. You're surrounded by contractors and other intermediaries, including academic institutions, who often depend on your support. And I don't think they're telling you what they really think. So those of us who throw stones at this industry and at the way Australia sometimes engages in the region are not sort of doing so for fun or out of spite. Read the stories at the start of our paper. They're not fictionalized. They're certainly not the exception. They're real and they're very painful. And when you read them, just ask yourself, honestly, how can aid of this sort of character really serve our interests or anyone else's?
Thank you, Sully, for this great conversation. Not only is this appreciated, but so too is your own leadership, your contestability, and the constructive way in which you are explaining your positions to listeners of our readout.
Well, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity, Bridie.
Join me next time on The Readout, where each episode we sit down with one author, one big idea, and talk about how it can shape the future of Australia's development assistance. If you liked hearing from Sully, you can find a link to her article in our show notes. And don't forget to check out our other episode on the same article with Sully's co-author, Dame Meg Taylor. If you want extra previews, insights, and development analysis, then sign up to our email at devintelligencelab.com. And finally, a special thanks to the lab team behind the scenes, Ruby St. Lencher and Walter Colnaghi. I'm Bridie Rice. This is The Readout. Talk soon.
We at the lab acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we extend our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We're inspired by the storytelling tradition of the world's oldest living culture, and we pay homage to it when we share our stories or intelligence on this podcast.